Welcome to the Trailhead, where trails start and stories unfold. Welcome to the show, everyone. Now here's JD.
Welcome to the Trailhead, where trails start and stories unfold. Today we're venturing into our Open Talks Open Trails series, focusing on the rugged beauty and the complex issues surrounding the San Rafael Swell and Bears Ears. These iconic landscapes are at the heart of a critical debate over public land access, a topic that affects every off-roader and outdoor enthusiast. Joining us are our seasoned trail companions, myself, JD, Ryan, Pope, Alyssa, and our special guest, Ben Burr from the Blue Ribbon Coalition. Ben brings a deep understanding of land management and off-road advocacy, shedding light on how decisions made far from these trails impact us all. We'll delve into the Dingle Act, unravel the intricacies of managing public lands, and discuss what this means for the off-road community. This isn't just about the trails we travel. It's about the legacy we leave behind and the rights we fight to preserve. So buckle up and tune in as we navigate the challenges and champion the cause of off-roaders everywhere. This is The Trailhead, where your journey into the great outdoors begins and the story of adventure and advocacy unfold. Welcome to The Trailhead. Trails start and stories unfold. I'm JD. Today we have a roundtable of sorts on a it's a Thursday that we're recording this. I'm kind of surprised by that. We've got Ryan. Hey, Ryan, how you doing?
Hey, how are y'all?
Doing all right. And Alyssa, how you doing?
Good. How's everyone?
Doing awesome. And then we got Pope. I think you are sans Randy today, correct?
It's just me today. Randy's working late, chopping some people's hair off, so...
It wasn't my hair. It was not mine.
Ben's was pre-done before the show got started, and it was
she got mine pretty good.
You didn't have any to begin with.
Oh, it was like down to a week.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. All right, and then of course we've got Ben Burr. How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me here again.
It's good to be back. This is the second time you're here from Blue Ribbon Coalition, and this will be technically the third episode because we were still kind of figuring things out and split your first episode into two. So, but this one's just going to be just this, and we'll try to keep it to a decent time today for you.
Okay, sounds good.
Real quick, there's no big business today. Normally, we would do a Blue Ribbon Coalition update early on in these kinds of shows. We'll talk more about the Bears Ear later, but the comment period is currently open. So when you're done listening today, make sure you go check out the Blue Ribbon Coalition site and get your comments in while you can for that one. And then if you've got other questions, there'll be show notes and all kinds of stuff. There'll be all kinds of resources that I put in the show notes. We'll be on the trailheadnetwork.com after we're all done. So awesome. Well, welcome back, Ben. The last time we had you was Moab, and we talked about that a lot. And there's no real big updates on that. I know that we've talked about kind of some of the updates, really just kind of, we got that first defeat, which was kind of expected, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're in the federal district court right now. We did ask for a preliminary injunction on the trail closures just because everybody really was so upset about these. We were worried that the BLM would get a bunch of volunteers out there with SUA and just go start closing everything, raking out the trails, putting in berms and gates and everything else. And then if we win, then to go reopen those trails again would be really difficult to get the BLM to do it.
Right.
And so that's the case we made to the judge back in Salt Lake in April. And he did not award the injunction. We knew going in that an injunction is a pretty high bar to clear, but we thought in this case it was merited, but we still haven't really yet gone to the merits of the actual legal challenge. And so we still have several months ahead of us there of preparing our motion for summary judgment. So we're still very much fighting that fight and have a ways to go.
So Ben, yeah, I just
from your experience, go ahead, Ryan. What's the percentage chance that we that you guys are able to overturn that?
To overturn the decision?
Yeah.
I think on this one with this judge, I feel good about our chances. You never want to like predict those things, but what I do know is what the deficiencies in the plan are. And we've reviewed a lot of the analysis. The analysis is deficient. And the way they chose to close certain routes over others is deficient. The things they ignored, they didn't respond to a lot of the comments and substantive concerns we raised. And we also are concerned some things we'll probably talk about today with the Dingell Act. I mean, they did create buffer zones around a wilderness. You're not allowed to do that. And that's a relatively new claim that we don't often make in these cases, but in this one we are. And we also, our attorney really wanted to look into the question that's been kind of floating around out there about which officers acting on behalf of like a president in the executive branch have the authority to do that. And so you really have, it's called the appointments clause, is that a president can delegate his authority, but then the people making substantive decisions for the government have to have the right line of authority there. And when you get to like the lower levels of an agency like the BLM, it's questionable whether that authority has been properly delegated. I mean, I think I'm explaining that the right way. The attorneys might like a different explanation, but so it's an appointment clause challenge. And so that's constitutional. So we're bringing a lot of different claims to this that we think are legitimate concerns. We'll have our day in court. Some of these are like the appointments clause claim is one that I think would be one we would appeal, you know, up to like the circuit court or somewhere else, because it's a, it really is a question of how we've delegated authority down through this administrative state apparatus. It's clearly not working well for the people, right? I mean, maybe if you're on SUA,
reaction when people are actually starting to pay attention. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're SUA, you disagree with me on that. And, but then they would change their tune as soon as like a president, like President Trump were in office, then all of a sudden they would have a lot of the same concerns. And so it all boils down to, we're doing what we can. We're using the judicial branch of the government. We still have the Historic Roadways Protection Act. We were talking to a contact in DC and ours today, who's working to help us get some more support for that in Congress, so that we're not just focused on the court battle here. We're going to do everything we can to get those trails reopened. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work to do still. And
I think that's a really good segue then into kind of the Dingell Act and how we got to where we're at with the San Rafael swell. Because one of the questions that I had is, and we'll talk about more about what the Dingell Act is and how it got us to where we are. But who are the people that are making these plans? Who are the people that are making these decisions about what's going to be open and closed? Like these are folks that are, they're not elected officials, right? They're not usually people who are environmental scientists or anything like that. They're just bureaucrats.
Yeah, they're field managers or district managers of the Bureau of Land Management, or in the Forest Service, it's like a district ranger, or National Park Service, you would have a superintendent. And they're called, the term they used to refer to all of them is the decision makers. And they are unelected. They're usually just people who start off a career in one of the agencies. And one way or another, they get on the track of being on the decision-making track. And so you'd maybe become like an assistant field manager and then a field manager. And it's really, I mean, I've done some like consulting work where you kind of get deep into the inner workings of different offices of these agencies. And it's a pretty nasty little political ladder that they're climbing in this sense. And I've seen a lot of people get moved around for if they get crosswise with the wrong group or the wrong rancher or the wrong environmentalist. It's like, instead of you get promoted through, instead of getting fired, you get promoted. And so usually the people that are climbing the ladder are having done so from getting fired from being on the wrong side of an issue. And so it's kind of like this
failing upwards. Yes.
Bizarro land meritocracy where it like you can't fire them. And so you relocate them to a different job with a promotion. And so we call it like they got shipped off to Winnemucca or somewhere.
like Winnipesaukee. Nice.
And the guy I worked with who trained me how to do a lot of this work, he was a Forest Service supervisor for a period of time, and they moved. If you really get in trouble, they ship you to D.C. and put you in some basement of a brick building on Constitution Avenue. And they would send me to go write a report, and I'd bring it up, and they'd be like, this is good. Go do it again. It was like being in some Kafka novel of misery. I don't know. I mean, it's the agents. So that's who they are. I mean, I think most of them are. There is some sincerity there, though. They do want to make good decisions. They don't want to get sued, but
It feels like they're overwhelmed. It feels like they're overwhelmed and underinformed on a lot of it.
Yeah, and they have an impossible mandate. Like they are told you have to manage this for mining and for environmental protection and for ranching and for recreation and for all these things. And then we've given this like crazy amount of power to the environmental litigators to basically just beat the crap out of them whenever they want. And so there isn't a way to do their job successfully. It's impossible. And so if you're looking at like a market system, right, there's incentives, it's capitalism, it's like profit motive or prices and supply and demand. There's like all these things we can study and say, this is what informs a decision. And this bureaucracy in the administrative state, it's corruption. It's politics. So that's what moves the needle. It's not something rash. And I guess there's something rational somewhat to it, but it really is more of about power plays and who's controlling the top.
Ben, I was going to ask, I've not heard much about it. So explain to me the Dingell Act. What is that?
Yeah, the Dingell Act was a bill that was passed in 2019, and it was a bit like the Congress every couple years will pass new legislation that will affect public land. They usually call it a public lands package of some kind. They called this one the Dingell Act because the lead sponsor in the House of Representatives was Representative Dingell, and so it was named after that individual. So it was a big bundle of a bunch of public land bills. As far as Utah goes and the San Rafael Swell, it was the Emery County, which is the county where the San Rafael Swell is located, had been working on a county-specific public land bill where they wanted Congress to really set in stone how they wanted some things to work in their county. We'd seen another one of these in Washington County, which is where I live. These county-specific bills kind of get sold as, we're now going to go in and fix all the problems for good. And once we pass this, everybody was here. We had all the stakeholders weigh in. And now we've fixed all these problems. And all I found is that they just kind of reshuffle the decks, chairs of the Titanic. They just create new problems. They fix some problems. And then there's a whole bunch of other unintended consequences. And so I am like kind of opposed to county specific public land bills at this point, because I haven't seen one really work out very well yet. And that was included in the Dingell Act. And that's a lot of what will come into play with the San Rafael Swells, because there's all these new rules for this area.
So what were some of the initial things that the Dingell Act was supposed to do? Like for the San Rafael Swell, it was 663,000 acres?
Of wilderness.
Wilderness?
Yeah. And so Emery County went into this with a gun to their head, literally. I mean, they were saying, we're going to turn the whole thing into a national monument unless you guys come to the table and come up with a reasonable compromise, a balanced compromise. We want to balance the management of the San Rafael Swell. And if you guys don't come up with a codified way to do that through legislation, then we're just going to make a national monument and do an end run around all of you and then still get what we want. And so one of the things that happened, which kind of still shocks me today, that you had a Republican delegation in Utah willingly create 660,000 acres of designated wilderness, which is it's the most restrictive form of land access you can have. And I got into a debate with one of the staffers who was negotiating this. And I was like, why are you guys doing this? They're like, well, they'll make it a monument. I'm like, okay. I mean, monuments are bad, and I, I haven't really seen a national monument turn out well, but they're still not quite as restrictive as a wilderness designation.
Right.
They're also not quite as permanent. This was happening after President Trump had just reduced the monument boundaries of Grand Staircase and Bears Ears. And so we were starting to see that the national monument, like, air of impenetrability wasn't real. Like, you really could change how a monument gets managed if you got a president in office that saw the injustice of it.
Right.
And so to go create congressionally designated wilderness was just flat out idiotic. And it's what they did, though. And they'll defend it and they'll say, well, we cherry stemmed in some of the roads and we also created a recreation area and we did all these other things too. It wasn't just wilderness. And it's like, end of the day, though, headline for me is they created 660,000 acres of wilderness and really put a big chunk of the Santa Fe swell off limits. And that's done. That's already happened. That's where we're starting from on right. this Santa Fe swell travel plan.
Oh, it's not pretty. So I do have it pulled up here. Let me see if I can grab it. So we've got here, that's the areas it currently is, correct? So yeah. Alternative A, no action. And those are all red. Reds are already closed, correct?
Yeah, this one's the way they're doing this was a little different because alternative A is the current management. And what's happened is they have gone out and inventoried a bunch of routes that, according to the BLM, are technically not open, is how I understand it.
Okay.
But if you were to go look at those red routes, they would be there. They'd be open. You'd see trail tracks on them. There wouldn't be any signs telling you not to go there. The only way you could possibly know they're not open is if you somehow went on the BLM website, download their KMZ file, and created a map like this for yourself. Like, they're not publicly advertising what the route system is in a meaningful way. And it's a lot. And it's very confusing. I mean, I've been operating off of the scoping map for years in this area, which is basically this. But for now, I mean, those red routes on alternative A are ones that could be considered. And so that's why if you click to alternative D, go to D next. And so D is what is the most open alternative they'd be considering in this plan. Usually it's A that is the most open. And so some variation of alternative D is something we would probably be supporting in this, other than I still think there's even missing routes on alternative D. And so it's not like this is like a full endorsement of alternative D, but it's a pretty good starting point for what we want to see happen in the Santa Fe swell.
I mean, in that's a lot. That's just a lot of red.
And so that's alternative B.
There we go. I can do that. Allows me to switch back and forth between the two. So,
yeah.
So between D and B, that's a lot more closure.
Correct.
And this area is gorgeous. I feel like there's a lot of times that there's a lot of people just don't know that this area exists in some way, shape, or form. And it doesn't help if you're not publishing the actual routes that are legal.
Yeah. But for now, I mean, I think the public needs to go out and explore a lot of these routes. I mean, I think the public needs to know what they're losing. They need to see it firsthand. There's a lot of trails that are very popular in the Santa Fe swell, and a lot of those did get cherry stemmed in. So that was one of the silver linings of the Dingell Act, which is like, turn to alternative B. Show us B so we see the red lines. Okay, so you see in the top right portion of that main section, that's the Mexican Mountain Wilderness. Scroll down. Lower. So now go down a little bit. See where it says Mexican Mountain? Right there. Yeah.
You want me to get any closer?
No, you're good there. So you see that green road that's going right through the middle of it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a cherry stem road. That means that road won't be closed. That Congress put in the act that road can't be closed. So that'll be open by legislative statute forever, until the Dingell Act is repealed or something.
Okay.
But I look at that and I say, well, that area of wilderness there's other roads that have already been closed now that you can't see, but there were probably enough roads in that area that it shouldn't have been eligible to be designated a wilderness, because wilderness is 5,000 contiguous acres without a road.
Oh, and, I see.
And so when they go close all the roads, then it makes, like, I don't think that most of this area was even eligible. And when they cherry stem in a road, what that means is there's a little corridor around that road that's technically not the wilderness. And that's how they're able to get to the 5,000 acres, is especially if the roads are like transecting the whole section. And so
the first time I ran into that was in Grand Junction.
Yeah. So, I've seen our environmentalists argue that cherry stemming is like this trick they do to keep roads in a wilderness. And it's the exact opposite. It's, we wouldn't have the wilderness designation without the cherry stem.
Right.
And so, but then you go, so now I want you to stay zoomed in here, and you see up on the north boundary of this Mexican mountain wilderness area, all those red routes. So those will all be closed. If you were to erase those, you would now have a new boundary, which is that green route up where those are all stemming down from. And then the blue square of the Sitla portion, and then that route, that will become the new wilderness boundary if they close all those routes. And so another thing the Dingle Act said is, we're going to create all this wilderness, but you can't create a buffer zone around the wilderness.
Right.
So if they close all those routes around the wilderness, one, you won't be able to access the wilderness, which you do have a right to do. You don't, I mean, the roads that lead up to the wilderness are how you access it. And so to create that buffer zone too creates huge statutory problems for this, to the point that I don't even think alternative B is a legitimate alternative under NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, because those alternatives all have to be compliant with the law. And they're creating so many buffer zones through these route closures that they're violating the Dingle Act on its face. And so if they release this as they're currently planning, they're releasing an illegal alternative right out of the gate.
Like, I mean, you can, it's pretty, you can see it as you go around the map. You can see where those new areas would just expand it. And it's just that, and we've talked about it before, it's that slow step forward and just trying, we're going to get, you know, we're going to ask for 300, we're going to get 100. We're going to ask, you know, and then next time we're going to ask for 200 and then get 50. We're going to keep asking. We're just going to inch it closer and closer and closer to what we want.
Yeah, well, and if you go read what SUA is saying about this plan now, I mean, when they released these preliminary maps, SUA released a statement and they said, now finally, the BLM can bring balance to the management of the San Rafael Swell. That was the argument we had back when we made the 600,000 acres of wilderness. And they left us 200,000 acres of recreation area in the middle. That's all, like, if you look at all those green routes in the middle of that area that's all circled by wilderness. That's the special recreation management area. So they prioritize recreation in 240,000 miles of acres, and then 670,000 is wilderness. And that was balanced back then to have 3-to-1 wilderness protected versus 1 acre of recreation. And now they're coming and saying, we need to bring even more balance to this. This is still unbalanced.
In order to bring balance to the additional people that want to go out and experience this wilderness, we should close more routes and make it more concentrated and busier and harsher on the environment.
And so that's a narrative everybody has to push back on. Like, if SUA releases a post that says we need to bring balance to this, go flood their thing with comments of, you got 660,000 acres of wilderness in here. How is that not balanced already? And if they start complaining about endangered cactuses or spotted owls or anything else,
I guarantee you,
it will be all those things. Mm-hmm. You can say, that is great. We love the Mexican spotted owl as much as everybody does. And that's why there's the SIDS Mountain Wilderness to protect habitat for that owl. And the Mexican Mountain Wilderness protects habitat for that. There's 660,000 acres of the most protected habitat for that owl on the continental 48. United States. So that owl's habitat is already protected by this plan because of the wilderness designations, but they act like those don't count.
Right.
That we have to still close more. Yeah. And so those are things we have to push hard on with this, because they're not right on the facts on this, and they're not right on the balance. And your listeners, everybody needs to be pushing back on it.
And I think it's pretty clear. And, you know, I had a conversation with somebody pretty recently, and they are just like, you know, there's people out there and they're damaging trails and they're doing this, that. And I said, just give me one study that actually shows that at any significant level. Just give me something that actually says it, that other than you just saying it out loud and trying to speak it into existence. And there's just not a lot of it. There's not a lot of categorical evidence of a lot of the claims that have been made so far about stuff like this, and especially in areas like this.
I did find one piece of garbage out there the last time I was there.
Uh-oh.
One?
Just one.
Was it
just one. It was just one piece of garbage.
A whole can? Nope. Or?
Nope. Keep guessing.
Oh, damn. Here we go again. The last time I had to guess, it was about weird parrots coming into the...
Yeah, it wasn't weird parrots. Nothing weird parrots. What do you think, Alyssa? What do you think I found? It was some garbage.
Alyssa's what's talking to me.
There you go. It wouldn't turn on. I don't know. I'm too scared to say.
Too scared.
Oh, I think I know. I think I know what Alyssa thinks it is. Yeah.
No, it was nothing explicit. Okay. Nothing. Probably. I mean, what do you think?
Guess.
What do you think?
Was it a North Face jacket?
You're getting close. You are getting warmer, my friend.
That was a good one.
Tell me it was a Patagonia.
Colder. Well, no, it's still probably warmer. Warmer.
Ryan?
What is it? R.I.? What's the one I never
heard of? I'll give you a hint. It was a hubcap from a vehicle.
I was going to say a tire.
Gotta be a Volkswagen. Did I say it out loud?
There's a Subaru hubcap from a Subaru.
There it is. Subaru. Yep. That sounds
wow, pretty close.
So I picked it up and told my friend, I'm like, we should make a video. Like, hey, Sua, one of your members left this out here. They're trashing the place.
Like, I tell you, it's not us.
Yeah. Like, what? I don't know what brand of side by side this came off of, but we need to. This is why trails get closed.
Yeah. You know those side-by-sides and their hubcaps. Oh, my God. That's amazing. That sounds about right, though. Like, I don't, the damage just isn't there. And it's just, I don't see it. I just don't see it.
Yeah,
and
what I saw a post the other day about all the rock stacking.
Mm-hmm.
They panned across the picture, and I guess my comment kind of was, you know, I guess leave no trace only applies to a few. When the other half really don't have to abide by it, you know, because they're going to close it anyway. So, you know, they can do whatever they want, I guess. I don't understand the double standard that fits.
Yeah. Well, and we try not to get too much into the weeds with that stuff. Cause like it's, you know, it's part of that is, yeah, I mean, the rock stacking's an issue unto itself, but it's not nearly the environmental issue that some make it out to be. And then for the rest of everybody, and I think some people just like to complain. I think it's just
a lot of times out here, what we've seen is the rocks that were there got washed out when we had record snowfall last year. So some of the stuff is
gone. Especially in washes and in Utah. Exactly. You're going to get that a lot. Has there been any movement on there was a bunch of mining sites and some Cold War locations. I didn't see what the Cold War locations were.
If you zoom into that map, zoom into the middle of it. And so if you go into like the heart of the San Rafael Swell, you'll see these little route systems that kind of look like spider webs. Zoom over to the left a little bit. A little bit more. Yeah, so all those little spurs you're starting to see there are access roads to old mining sites. If you go down and to the left a little bit more, you'll see more of them.
Gotcha.
And so this area was like heavily explored for uranium mining. And I've been out there. I've seen a lot of these mines and it's really cool. You can go into the sites. There'll be like old outhouses and old cars, and cabins, and if you see like tin cans out there, those are actually protected artifacts, just like a Native American pot would be because they're historically significant. And so to get into them, you really have to kind of off-road your way into them. It's not like you're going to a visitor center at a national park. They're really in the deep backcountry of this area.
Right.
And then you get to the sites, and if you click on Alternative B, so you see what happens to those spider webs.
Right.
They all get closed.
Right.
And so the Dingell Act said that that BLM is required to keep those open for educational purposes. And it wasn't like as explicit as saying every little route that goes into these, you have to keep open, but it said you have to make them accessible to the public, and they're clearly like closing them. And so I don't know how they're going to be accessible as somebody who's been into them. It's not like they're going to, I don't envision that it would increase the educational experience to go build like a kiosk and a visitor center there. It's cool just to go explore the site. and yeah, walk around and go poke ways. Around mm-hmm. and drive in and out of it. And people sometimes camp in them. And it's like,
I mean, I think you poked on it at the beginning though, like these are, you have to off-road to get to these places. And there's a reason why these things still exist despite what I would consider the worst human nature of some of us. Yeah. And you know, that these, you go out to these sites and these places, these things still exist. There's no graffiti on them. They exist out there as historical landmarks, and people aren't damaging them because they're going to see them. They're going to see them because they're historical landmarks.
Yeah. And so, and the thing that's frustrating to me is when Congress was debating this, the Dingell Act, the staffers that I spoke to after the fact, they're like, well, we put in these great protections. It's the first time we've ever done it to protect these historical sites that will keep the routes open. Yeah. I'm like, well, why isn't that working, sir? I mean, it's not happening. They're proposing to close them. And maybe they won't. Maybe this is just an alternative and the BLM isn't seriously considering it. But the statutory right. protection for keeping those routes open is high. And right. for that reason, I don't think it's a viable alternative to release one that closes those.
Right.
And
I think the concern is high considering the recent actions. There's no reason to think that they would, that alternative D or even C would be really on their agenda or radar.
Maybe. I mean, I think maybe they expected the backlash they got, but moving on to Bears Ears. Once that Moab plan came out, they had a deal. Like, you see all those little blue squares on your map there? Those are those are pieces of land owned by the state of Utah, our state institutional trust lands. And those are there to fund our school system through the use of those lands. And so that's why a lot of times if there's like mining claims or residential real estate developments or things that go into SITLA properties, that money goes to our school system. And so when a president comes in and designates a national monument, they basically say, we want you to trade out all the SITLA land and we'll give you BLM land somewhere else. And so if you look at Utah's map, there'll be these big blocks of these blue shaded lands where they've traded out SITLA lands because of certain federal actions that led to it. And there's a lot of us who opposed trading out the SITLA parcels and Bears Ears because I want the SITLA parcels and Bears Ears. The BLM has to maintain access to the SITLA parcels. There's a decision called the Cotter decision, which sets a precedent where if I'm the state of Utah and I come to the BLM and say, hey, I want a road to that SITLA parcel. If there wasn't one that exists, they have to build you one. They have to let you access those. And so for the state to forfeit its SITLA holdings within a monument means you're really access. Handing it over. Right. And so they had put together a trade. To trade out 160,000 acres of land in Bears Ears for other land elsewhere. And once they've released these management plans, the state pulled out of the deal. They said, we're not negotiating with this administration anymore. You're not operating in good faith with us. They were trying to be good partners on these plans, and then they just railed them on the Moab plan. What we're seeing in these monument management plans is they're just completely ignoring and discrediting the state's concerns, comments, and interests. So I would be in, we'll see if they want to try and get back in good graces, but you also have a administration in an election year, and I would expect the worst. You know, we need to be planning for the worst, that they'll close a lot. And I'm starting to move away from just the language of saying they're just shutting down our public lands or they're closing our trails. What's right. really happening is an elitist purge of the common average middle-class American from being able to go out and access these. If you're not doing the preferred activity of a handful of elite people that want to turn all of these areas into like enclaves for billionaires, that's what's happening. And go try and buy some real estate in Crested Butte, Colorado. See if you can go buy it with a middle-class job. Go try to buy it in Moab, Utah. Like, this is happening all across the West. The average Americans are getting priced out of these communities. And then I don't know if you're watching this Cane Creek development in Moab, where they want to build some houses up along the Colorado River somewhere.
Yeah, I was watching that in... I just noticed that when I was there at EJS, and it looked like it's already kind of designated as some sort of a nature reserve, that they're building a neighborhood right in the middle of it.
Yep. Surprise, Sua. Oh, did you not see this coming? You've like been setting this up for the billionaires to come in and take over this town for the last 30 years. And now they're showing up with their bulldozers to build their dream homes in your canyon. And it's like, oh, we got to stop the development. I'm like, yeah, it's a dump. Like,
it's too late. It's a disgrace.
But you guys did this. This is your fault. You turned this into like a magnet and a wilderness preserve that brought these people here and all of this money. And now guess who's going to buy you out?
And they'll be lucky if they get bought out. They'll be lucky if there's not some sort of eminent domain situation that gets them booted out. So
yeah, and that's some of the other things we've opposed this year, like the natural asset company rule, where they wanted to like sell off leases and conservation easements to Wall Street firms. I think they're kind of useful idiots at this point, and there are some like hardcore believers of the cause, but just wait. If Sua gets their way,
yeah,
the West becomes an enclave for billionaires. You will not be able to live here. And
including those SUA members that have been paying the bills for all of this litigation.
Except there's one little loophole there. Is the one thing the billionaires also want is some sort of philanthropic vanity project. And so if you are like a nonprofit staff, you might be able to live in the servants' quarters and run a nonprofit and
and go outside and take some pictures once in a while to show people what they're missing.
Yeah. And so it's like, if people don't see this as an assault on, it's as much a class war as it is something about the environment. It really is that having a bunch of middle class people in Jeeps driving around on dirt roads in the backcountry doesn't fit the agenda.
Yeah. I mean, the Cane Creek development is a real, real good example that you can see with your own eyes what happened. It's a fact. You can go see it.
It's a microcosm of where this is headed. If you don't like that, like I've heard rumors that like the town of Hanksville kind of leaves in Utah, which is like if you're going down to like the Henry Mountains or Bullfrog or something, there's some properties as you come into town where it's like old wrecking companies from like tow trucks on I-70. And there's been like attempts to try to get them to clean up their properties and not have a bunch of like have it not look like a garbage dump. And they're like, yeah, but it's keeping the Californians away, so let's keep it there.
That sounds about right. I stayed a couple nights in Hanksville. That sounds about right.
And it's not, to be fair, I actually have a lot of Californians that I like, and I think California has a lot of awesome people in it. But that's just kind of the attitude in the West, that if you get these like rich coastal elites moving into your town, you will lose your town. And it's happening right in front of our faces.
And I think,
So long, Moab.
There's part of me that, like, there's part of me that's like, okay, fine. Moab can fade away into the annals of history if it wants to. There's places like Green River, and there's places like the Sand Hollow, and all that stuff that seem to want that business at some level. But I worry that stuff like this is just going to choke off the land completely from people being able to, from any of these towns ever being able to get a foothold on that kind of a tourism level.
Yeah, and it will. I mean, Sand Hollow, at least you have like a big town down by Sand Hollow, which kind of buffers some of that impact. When you get into something as small as Moab or Green River, and Green River is being bought up by millionaires. There's a software developer whose last name is Vallejo, who's been out there buying up all the farms and properties and...
I had a Green long River. Talk with the owner of the B&B out there, and he, it's a situation out there of lots of big pockets and money, and it's gonna be real interesting to see what happens.
Which doesn't surprise. I'm surprised it took this long. Green River kind of reminds me of like if Breaking Bad had a baby with Yellowstone in some ways.
It is like I can't tell anybody listening to this right now that it is the most awesome town to stay in, but hotels are mostly nice, and it's an interesting little town.
It's an interesting town, and I say that endearingly because there's definitely some interesting characters there. But if you look at what Green River has to offer, I mean, if it has the river running right through it, like Moab, it's outside of town. And you could really have like a whole string of developments up along the riverbanks, and it'd be like San Antonio, where like people are going by boat from like restaurants and bars and places back. Like, it has like a ton of potential to be an awesome little tourist town. If
they, it's early if enough people... in its development. Yeah, it's early enough. In, you could actually build it out into what you needed a tourist town to be so it could and handle that influx of people.
Yeah, I think if you came in with those plans, you actually literally might get shot. So
it's that's a true story, though. I felt that way when I asked about it. When I asked about why there wasn't more off-roading in the area, and he proceeded to tell me that basically one or two out-of-town millionaires own stuff, and then three big melon people, and I don't mean that in any way, shape, or form. It's a town built on missiles and melons, and it's real interesting.
And they're still very much small town. And then the other thing that's kind of people don't underestimate is the access into the book cliffs that it provides, which is a unique and a very interesting part of the book cliffs. And so, yeah, that's your travel log from today. We got away from
the
fights for a minute.
We got to bring our blood pressure down every once in a while here, and Pope will tell you. we actively work to make sure that we keep Pope from getting red faced at all times during these shows.
I do enough damage to myself during the trails. I don't need to be mad at this too.
It's a true story though, especially lately. Yeah, you gotta. That's awesome. Yeah. Bears Ears is currently in comment, right? Like you can actually go and take a.
Yeah, so we have if you go to sharetrails.org, we have a form where you can fill out the comments for Bears Ears. They're taking public comment. They've released their resource management plan, which is kind of higher level usually than the travel plans we've been talking about, where they're looking at all the individual routes and deciding what to keep open. But this is like a zoning document. And so if they zone something as closed, that means all the routes down the road are going to be closed in that area.
Right.
And so it still is a very important part of the process that you have to engage in, but it's not as like granular where we can say, hey, go help us document an inventory routes. It's, are there areas there that you have visited, would like to visit? We need you to share your experience of if you've gone into Bears Ears. If not, there's a lot of iconic trails in there. And there are a lot of, I call it the OHV closure plan, because they don't have any alternative that actually expands and enhances recreation. It's just multiple alternatives for how to close things. And they will, all the alternatives do close a canyon called Arch Canyon, which is one of the best trails in the area. So if you haven't wheeled Arch Canyon yet, you better do it soon. It's one we'll definitely be fighting to keep open, but it's one that Sue has been fighting to close for decades. And they're going to try to do it through this plan.
And I know I want to, you mentioned something that makes me want to mention this one more time. And we kind of touched base about it with the swell stuff. But if you're going out there to the swell, especially if you're going out to the swell, and you're getting some pictures and information, is there a place where everybody can send that into you? Are you getting that stuff from Trails Off Road these days? What's your plan for kind of gathering that information?
Yeah, so I've been talking a lot with Trails Off Road. We've been working a lot with UPLA in Utah, and there's already a lot of information out there, which is getting, it's kind of a little confusing for, like, if I didn't know a lot about this, I could see how the public might be confused. But the official comment period for the swell isn't open yet, which means the comment period that would give you legal standing if they do something wrong. They expect it to be sometime in the next few weeks or months. Like we heard, they'd try to have it out by May. And then there will be at least a 30 or 45 day period where the public can go submit feedback. And once that official comment period opens, we'll have... We're developing our plan of how we want to gather feedback. And so it will probably be a mix of, we have our standard form comment that we have people send in.
Right.
But then we'll probably have a series of comments about specific issues is maybe how we're thinking of approaching this one, where we want to make sure it gets across to the BLM that we are concerned about some things. And the UPLA is working on a form where if people want to submit route inventory information and pictures and things like that, where that all gets concentrated into one place.
Okay.
And so we'll have all that. It's not quite ready yet. Cause we're kind of, once the BLM opens, then we'll open. And one thing I like to always say when we talk about this comment stuff is I still see it, and I'll probably still see it my whole life. But everyone's like, oh, go submit it to the BLM. If you submit it through like a form comment, it doesn't count. And to everyone that says that, I want them to get in writing from the BLM that it doesn't count. I promise you, you won't be able to get them to put that statement in writing because they know legally it counts. And second of all, we've been in litigation on the Moab plan for months now. We're still waiting right. for records from the BLM, and we're in litigation, like discovery, all that stuff. Like, and so what that means is I go into a lawsuit and we're fine because we had so many people submit comments through our system for that mm-hmm. plan. So we know what our people were saying, but if you right. don't submit through our system, then we have to wait to get your feedback through the legal discovery process from the BLM. And so you're giving all the intel to the agency, disadvantaging us in a lawsuit. So there's a reason we ask you to do it through our form, is because we want to have that same intel that the BLM has going into the decision. Yep. And so I do also want to second, though, when people tell you to customize your comment, we sure want you to do that if you have anything to add. Like our
yep.
boilerplate stuff is just to get your mind turning on this stuff, but we really want your substantive feedback.
There is a guide on the Trailhead Network that I put together, and I will continue to update that as time goes on about how to make an effective comment.
Yep.
And it's not that your comments aren't important when you just say, hey, I enjoy recreating in this area and I want to see it closed. It's just the BLM is going to take it a lot more seriously if you say, hey, I really enjoy recreating this area and I've been out on these trails here and these are the ones that I know about and I spent time here when I was a kid, those kinds of things. Those are the things that they really take into account on top of all the other concerns that we talked about.
But what I would add to that is on the San Rafael Swell, I can send you a link to this after the show so you can put it in the show notes. They have sure. the route reports published. This is a 9,000 page document because they're publishing 5 pages for each route. You need to go see what they're saying about each route.
Right.
And if they're saying this route doesn't have any purpose and you go ride it, and you find out the reason, and it goes to like a really awesome scenic overlook or campsite, then what I need your comment to say is, I read your route report for this route. You said this, directly quote them and say, that is not true. I've gone here. Here's my photographic evidence that you're wrong.
Right.
You like, that's a really good comment, because then if they still go through with it off of the inaccurate information, when we tried to correct them in a good faith, substantive way, that's where these things fall apart in a lawsuit. And that's why we think the Moab plan has a chance to get struck down, is because we did do that. Now, you guys know, right? I mean, you know, Patrick McKay, you've probably had him on the show. I don't know if you have yet or not.
Yeah, we had him on right before you, actually.
Yep. He wrote a 500 page comment, route specific concerns and feedback. They ignored a bunch of it.
Oh,
and
I'm sure.
That's why he's a plaintiff with us. And you can see it in the lawsuit why we've leaned on him so heavily. So we want there to be dozens of Patrick McKays out there just bombarding them with the truth, with facts of what's going on in these area, because we have a woman named Tammy Pike. She retired from the BLM. She used to do travel planning, and she has doing some trainings with us to teach our members how to do this. And we were in a meeting, and I was like, well, we go sit in a room for weeks and look at each trail and get our specialists to come in and talk about the resource concerns on each trail. And I'm like, that's a fine process, man. I understand why you do it. How many of that is based off of on the ground understanding of those trails? Like, well, none of it. We're never actually on the ground.
Right.
And I don't know that that's true in all cases all the time, but I do believe it's 100% true that no one has more on the ground experience in these areas than our members. I will put my members up against SUAS. I'll put them up against the BLM staff. I know our people are out there more than any of them combined. And we're not getting that knowledge into the administrative record, and we need to.
And I feel like we're starting to understand as a community, we're starting to get that. And if you're listening, like, it's, you know, if you're in one of these areas, or if you find, you know, there's been plenty of times where I've been out off-roading someplace and I find myself in an area I didn't expect to be in. So if you end up in the Swell and you find yourself just, you know, running random trails there that are on the map, make sure you take pictures. Suggest that you turn on the GPS tags on your cell phone for your pictures, so that you can locate them later, and B, so that they'll hold more weight when you submit them. But all of those things, that's easy information to grab. It's just where you were in a couple of pictures. It's not even, you know, we talked about some of the stuff that I gather for Trails Off Road and stuff like that. Those are, you know, that's a high level of information. We're gathering pictures and data and really detailed information. Just a few pictures and what you observe is all you need for a good BLM.
So Ben, talk to me a little bit about, I mean, I've heard you say in other forums and other platforms, you know, we, as a body of off-roaders and recreational folks, we trump, no pun intended there, but we trump the amount of people that the opposition has, right? There's no doubt. I mean, the amount of people that are into recreational vehicle, Jeeps, side-by-sides, motorcycles. But you guys always talk about the West Coast, and of course the BLM obviously has much more reign and power out there. But, you know, being an East Coast guy and having hundreds of thousands, if not Jeepers out here that necessarily don't go out to visit these places on a weekend basis, but want to at some point in time and believe that what is going on is not right. How do we get involved? How do we help the Blue Ribbon Coalition accomplish these goals if we can't go out and take pictures?
What Ryan's trying to tell you is that he's on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah. I sent an issue this morning about a guy in Alabama, a senator who's trying to shut down, I think, a private off-road park.
Yep,
and so it's not like that the East Coast is invulnerable to this. It works differently there. And we work on all of those issues nationally. I passed that on to a board member of mine who lives in West Virginia and is a state senator in West Virginia. And I think he's reaching out because the people weren't having a good chance, weren't having much luck connecting with their senator. And he's like, well, I'll make a call and see, and just kind of get to the bottom of it. And so there's a trail closure I saw in Georgia where the people were talking about on Facebook. And so I believe there's one of our biggest issues we've had in recent months was they want to close a bunch of trails in Wharton State Park in New Jersey. And so we do fight on the East Coast. It's just not as omnipresent of a problem as it is out here in the West. But to more directly answer your question, I see people say in comments, and people tell me all the time, they're like, well, SUA has $19 million on their balance sheet. How do we ever go up against that? And I kind of just laugh at them. I'm like, that's like actually kind of chump change. It's not that much money. And somebody was telling me that at the Salt Lake Off-Road Expo, they had like 36,000 people there. I'm like, if everybody who is here joined my organization for $5 a month, which was less than what they paid to enter to get into the thing, I would outfinance SUA in a weekend.
Right.
And if everybody in South Carolina or wherever was also joining BRC for $5 a month, we'd be bigger than the Sierra Club in a year. And they're a $200 million year organization.
Yep.
And so I'm not asking for a lot. I'm not asking for a billionaire like what SUA has to come open his checkbook. All I want is that everybody who likes doing this signs up to be a member for $5 a month, which means I get to represent you legally. BRC just wants to go into court by ourselves, it's not as strong as when we go in with a member. Another reason why we invited Patrick McKay to be a plaintiff on the lawsuit. We want to go represent our members. Right. And so the best way to strengthen what we're doing and give us more impact and hire more staff and take on more issues and fight in more areas is $5 a month, be a member. Seems we've tried to not make affordability the reason you're not joining. So which means it has to either be apathy or you just don't know. And well, if I can change either one of those things, then I'm good.
There you go. And that's why we got you here. We're working on that. We have a surprising amount of East Coast following. Thanks in part, I think, to Ryan. But I think just because we've been reaching out to them since the start, because I think they're an underrepresented group in a lot of ways. And we need to bring them into the fold because we have the anchorage, right? We have you talk about 633,000 acres of land being impacted by one decision. It's very easy to kind of wrap your head around that. It's a little harder to say, you know what, these people who live in a concentrated urban area in New Jersey who already don't have a lot of options are at risk of losing more road. And it doesn't always make the same impact.
Yeah, it's a different fight, but it's the same fight. And we want to fight for everybody, but you really, like, once you start stretching that far nationally, to go, for me to go in with lawyers and everything into New Jersey will take more resources than I have right now. Right. But I really want to do it. Like, right, state level things, you actually have, are way more open-ended, like open books, than the federal things when it comes to litigation pressure. Right. And so I've got to have
people waking up. It's all exponential, right? Like, you got to start with your big hitters first. And then once you can kind of make some headway with those and you get enough support, then you can start branching out to those areas where the return isn't as significant right out the gate.
But the impact might be more achievable right out of the gate. Exactly. And so we're always balancing those things, but that's all just to say we support East Coast work as well.
Yeah. I hope we took a chisel at the, empathy. What was the word? Sorry. I'm late. I've had
apathy.
Thank you. Empathy. Especially of the East Coasters. Cause it is, you can get disconnected from it very easily out here. But it's not good to know, but it's good to know that there's issues in Georgia.
It's good to be aware of what's going on.
Yeah. Aware of what's going on. And it's not just a Moab, a Wyoming and Idaho, an Arizona issue. We have the problem right here in our backyard, and we have representatives and senators that we can reach out to as well. And,
this fight on. Remind me if I'm remembering this correctly, because I've done a handful of podcasts recently, but was it with your show that we talked about the natural asset company rule that was on like page 68,000 of the Federal Register?
We talked about it. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That was you guys. We and some other groups of folks that got derailed. They pulled that rule. I don't know that it's like gone for good, but if you don't think that was going to affect the East Coast, you don't understand what was happening there. That was a way to get, they were looking at the entire planet. And the last time I checked, the East Coast is on the planet and wanting to sell these natural assets, the natural assets of our planet to these companies.
Seeing fields turn into solar panel farms.
Yeah. And they would have turned
massive.
That's going to happen in the West. The Biden administration's pushing that. And so we're affecting national things that do affect states that aren't just the public land states in the West.
Right.
Sometimes our engagement on these things is because that's where our base of support is, and our follow. It's the right thing to do. This gets the most press
because it's right.
Yeah, but it would have like our coalition of folks that were helping us stop that. A lot of them were Midwest and the people that live in the Great Plains and the area where all the agriculture is. And
here's the thing. Here's the other part of that. And this is a good place to round this out at. Like, that's a good success story, right? Like, this is not fruitless. There have been wins. There will continue to be wins. The more people that get involved, the more people that do the route checks, and the more people that do, you know, donate and help you guys at $5 a month or whatever that they can do to kind of just help move the ball, can continue racking up those wins and starting to kind of push back what feels and has felt like for the last year or so is just a tsunami of these kinds of decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure it was a clip from your podcast that we shared about that and got thousands and thousands of comments from. And so
it was either us or Snail Trail.
Yeah. No, I think I wasn't ready with this on Snail Trail. And then there was one I did like the Toyota Garage podcast crew. It might've been them. And it was either you or them. But maybe you guys had a hand in that. So that means you guys ticked off the Rockefeller Foundation and the New York Stock Exchange.
I don't mind. That was like our third episode, Ben. I have no problem. We ended up on a list right away. I'm well aware it was going to happen immediately.
So you guys are on lists now, and it's all kinds of fun. You guys should invite me back more often.
No, I'm you're welcome. Just you're welcome to come list. Back. Yeah,
not,
there you
not
go.
Not lists in general, just new ones. You know,
no shit.
Yeah, just new ones.
Oh boy. All right. Okay. Well, Ben, I feel like we've taken a lot of your time already. Pope or Ryan, you've used all your questions for today.
Sweet.
But Pope or Alyssa, you have any questions?
I don't. Thank you for explaining all of that, though.
It's a lot. It's a lot of info.
Yeah. That's, and I know there's a lot more too, but that was,
we only have an hour or so. Eye-opening. So yeah, we don't want to overwhelm anybody who's listening either. Pope.
I might've missed it. Did you mention how many miles of trail they're looking at closing in, San Rafael Swell?
I don't think we had a number. Did you have a number?
It's, there is, if you go to PLPCO, like the Utah Public Land Policy Coordinating Office, they call themselves PLPCO. They did release some like infographics of the mileage. I'm kind of waiting to see like what the BLM does before I get really official with that. But we know there's 2,160, give or take, that they're looking at. And okay. Alternative B would close at least half or more. And so this could be 1,000+ miles of closure.
Jesus.
And so it, like, this area is a lot bigger with a lot more routes. And so people, Moab is like more, like more people know it, mm-hmm. and it's nationally recognized.
Like the swell that we were looking at earlier are miles long.
Yeah. And they're counting I-70 as part of that going through. So maybe they'll close I-70 for us. And
there you go. Start there and then we'll talk.
I mean, yeah, if you just want to just gate it and then turn it into, you know, unmaintained road, we'll do the rest. We'll take
which
care of
goes,
it.
But that makes my point about the silliness of this cherry stem thing, because I-70 is one of the cherry stemmed routes that goes right through four of the wilderness areas. And so you could be standing on the border of a wilderness area with nonstop semi-trucks driving by you.
But I am sure that the oil and rubber runoff from the road is not getting into the wilderness, Ben. It's all contained right to that highway, isn't it?
That area right next to the freeway is untrammeled by man. So it's wilderness.
There's a special bubble that was installed. Yes, I get it. Oh, that's amazing. All right. Well, all right, cool. Well, I appreciate it. And I appreciate it. Ben, you're welcome back anytime. Anytime
we'll
you
want to
come back and chat with us. We got through half of what we kind of laid out just in case we ran out of time, and I didn't think we would, but I really appreciate you coming by, man. And then, anytime you'd like. And if you're listening to this, hit us up at thetrailheadnetwork.com. There's going to be links to all of this stuff in the show notes. This will be up well before it's going to be up. I'm going to push this up so it airs a little bit sooner. And then, so it'll get up before Bear's Ears comments and get all that kind of stuff in there. I'll have articles, links to the articles about how to leave comments, links to the BRC places to submit those comments. So any link that you find on the Trailhead Network is going to go back to the BRC so that you can set up a comment through them. Ben, I already took my email tracker out of it, so you're good.
Okay.
So, sounds good. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. And any final thoughts for today, Ben? You're the guest.
Defend your ground, which is
defend your ground.
Actually, like, we have our defend your ground t-shirts.
I need one.
Wrote an opinion editorial in one of the Moab papers saying that defend your ground is too aggressive.
Yeah, well, you know,
and
what
we're hurting people's feelings. So if you want to
really
defend your ground,
aggressive for a very long time. So here we are. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is what it is. You're never
closing down our trails is also pretty aggressive. So here we are.
Exactly. Well, on that note, let's leave it at that. All right, guys. Thank you very much. Ben, hang out for just one second, man. Okay. Everybody else, y'all have a great night.
Awesome. Thanks, Ben.
See ya.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Good night.